Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hello and welcome to the last in our four-part podcast series, How to Win a Grand Slam. I'm Owen Slott, Chief Rugby Correspondent of The Times, and for the last time here we are looking at success in the Six Nations. How and why is it that some nations sometimes just get it all right? My guest today is John Rutherford, one of the absolute best, a giant in his time. When he started as Scotland fly half in 1979, Scotland hadn't won a Grand Slam for 54 years. In his sixth season of asking, they finally got it done. John, great to see you.
Owen, lovely to be here. I had a great train journey up.
You came from Selkirk?
Yes.
So you're still the Selkirk man through and through?
Yeah, I think I'll probably be carried out of Selkirk, but I did have a spell in Edinburgh. I was a school teacher at Watson's, and I did actually teach the Hastings boys, which probably a lot of people don't know, and I finished up playing in the same team. But no, back in Selkirk, very happy and still got a good connection with the local club. In fact, I am their membership secretary, Owen, so I'll be expecting you to be a member by the end of this.
Okay, well, if that's a deal, then fine. So listen, for our listeners, I just want to describe the man sitting in front of me. So, John, you're 64.
I am.
You've got pretty much all your hair. Though it is white.
It's grey.
Yeah, okay, grey. Well, whichever.
Yeah.
You're looking very healthy.
Yeah.
Which is a poignant point in itself, isn't it? Because two years ago you weren't.
Oh, unfortunately. 2 years ago, my wee brother died of prostate cancer. And he was living in Spain at the time. And it was actually really nice for... I've got an older brother, and we actually spent the last month in Spain with Billy. We're really quite close. But when I got back, my GP, who's the doctor for the rugby club, he said, right, I want to get you tested, John, because this stuff tends to be in families. So I said, look, his name is Jeff. Jeff, I'm fine, I'm fit, I go to the gym, I don't smoke. You know, I like a beer, but I'm not a big drinker. He said, it doesn't matter, I want to get you tested. So I went along and got the test, and they took 10 cuts from the prostate, and 8 of them had cancer, so I had to make a big decision. So it was a very difficult year, that, Owen, but I've got through it, I'm clear, I get tested quarterly, but I really feel great, and I feel blessed that, you know, because I've lost a lot of friends with cancer, and I've lost friends with prostate cancer. And I really feel as if I've been one of the lucky ones.
Oh, well, good for you in that respect. But you're through and out the other side, you think?
Yes. There is a possibility that it can come back. And that's why I'm tested every 3 months. But at the moment, it's looking good.
Can you still kick a spiral of 50, 60 yards?
This is a funny story. I got a call from a father. And his son's quite a promising player. So I went down to Phillip Hawk.
And the Selkirk ground.
At Selkirk, yes. I said, right. So I got all the balls out. So
this is just recently?
This is only maybe 2 months ago.
Right? Fantastic.
And so I was watching him kicking, and his technique wasn't great. I said, right, look, I just want you to watch this. I pulled my hamstring. First kick, Owen. I couldn't demonstrate anything afterwards, so it was a bit difficult. So could I kick a ball 60 metres? No, 6 metres now, maybe.
When was the last time you just did a place kick, a conversion kick, just for fun, just to go, well, this is what I used to be quite good at?
When my kids were playing mini rugby, right. School rugby, okay. I'd get in, and we were lucky to have a big garden at the house, and it was always Murrayfield, Twickenham one day, Wembley sometimes as well. So we played a lot of sport in the garden.
Excellent. John, we're going to sort of go back to 70s, 80s when you were playing your rugby. And do you get told a lot, do you meet people a lot who say to you how bloody good you were back in the day? I'm sure you're not going to say, yes, I was outstanding, but you were a peerless number 10 in your time. There were some people who said that you're arguably the best in the world in your time, and you're sitting here nodding, not quite sure what to say. But do you get that a lot?
When I stopped playing, yes, a lot of people would come up to me in the street. But it's much nicer now. You know, because I'm 64, I'm probably not recognised by younger people. But I had a lovely experience. I went to an Edinburgh game recently, and I was sitting having dinner with a couple of Selkirk lads, and this gent came over. He just said, look, I just want to shake your hand. I was your biggest fan, and I can't believe I'm standing here speaking to you. And I'm sure players of my vintage have had a similar experience. And it's really nice, Owen, because, you know, you do forget that, you know, we used to strut our stuff on the international pitches, and, you know, you put on a bit of weight and you think, God, was I really out there? But, I mean, that is 35 years ago. So it's lovely when people come up and still recognise you.
Good. Good for you. But you were, when you were a kid, you wanted to be Barry John, correct?
I did. I always thought if I could play rugby like him, and I recall vividly Cardiff were playing Gala, and Gala would have been probably the top side in Scotland at the time, and Cardiff were up playing, and I was pitch side, and I was 5 metres away from Barry.
How old would you have been?
I would have probably been about maybe 12, 13 at the time. But I've got a lovely story years later, Owen. It might have been my first or second game down in Cardiff. And after the game, we were sitting in the Angel Hotel. And it was a few Welsh boys, a few Scottish boys. We were having a beer. And there was a tap on my shoulder. And I turned around and it was Barry John, who I'd never met before. And he was my hero. And I stood up and bowed. I just felt that was the appropriate thing to do, because he'd been such a big person in my life. And Barry couldn't have been nicer. So I met him all these years later.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. When you were coming through and breaking into the Scotland team, so you made your debut in 79, what was rugby like then? I mean, we're so used to the professional age. I just wonder if you could paint a picture of, I don't know, how often did you train?
Yeah.
How did you find out if you were in the team? You know, everything was...
Oh, and it was, well, I seem very amateurish. It was totally amateurish. But at the top, players did take things seriously. And I was lucky, I was a PE teacher, so I did understand about conditioning. So at that time, I would have probably done something most days. I would have been in the gym certainly twice a week. You would have your club training on a Tuesday, Thursday. Now, once you get into the Scotland squad, you used to train Sundays. So it was club game on a Saturday, and then the squad would meet at Murrayfield on the Sunday. And we had tough coaches, you know, people like Jim Telfer, Derek Grant, Niamh McEwen, who was my first coach. And they were very aware that we didn't have huge numbers of players in Scotland, and we weren't the biggest of teams, so we had to be fit. And I do remember doing a heck of a fitness work. So I think Scotland were possibly ahead of their time in terms of conditioning and fitness. And we did, when we were playing, we always had a good last 20 minutes, which was a sign that we were fit. And when we played the best sides, we could always hang on in there.
Mm.
And a lot of that was to do with your conditioning.
But you would train in, where would you train, up here in Edinburgh?
Yeah, well, I was working at Watson's College.
Sure,
so okay. There was great facilities.
But you would have played for Selkirk on a Saturday.
I did, uh-huh.
And then the day after you'd be training.
Yeah.
Which modern parlance, just sat there, you go, you're nuts, you know.
I couldn't have played for anyone else. I was certainly asked, but my dad was on the committee, my mum was a tea lady, my two brothers played for the team, so if I left Selkirk, I don't think anybody would have spoken to me again. So that's why I've really had a lifelong association with the club.
And when the Scotland thing started happening, how long before a game would the team gather? Yeah. And
well, the rules at that time were you could only meet 2 days before the game. So teams would meet up on the Thursday, and that's where you did most of your work. But Owen, there'd be very little analysis. You'd maybe be lucky to get 10 minutes watching your opponents play. When you think of the analysis that's done on matches now. But because all teams were the same,
yeah,
it was kind of equal. So he went out and...
Did you not have watched the whole of the match of your opponents beforehand?
Not, I mean, Owen, not
there
really.
There was VHS. You could have recorded it, John.
Yeah, you did, but I think probably Roy Laidlaw and I, we maybe did a wee bit more than other players.
Just stop you there, because that's the first mention of Roy, who's kind of your twin brother, baby brother or whatever, little brother. You and Roy played, your careers spanned... The we years did. Together, mm-hmm. I think you had 35 tests together. He was 90 or 10.
Yeah. Well, Owen, you know,
we all like to think that you're best buddies.
We were very close, Roy. There's incredible similarities between the two of us in that one of our parents came from Glasgow, married a border lass. He's the middle son of three brothers. I'm the same. And we both went on to have three sons. The story goes on, and we really played as a half-back partnership from 18 onwards, so we knew each other.
People like myself would like to imagine that you and Roy still meet twice a week and spin a ball
Owen, it's not, he still lives in Jed, and we would play, certainly in the summer, we'd play golf every couple of weeks.
Right.
And we would speak on the phone probably every week. Yeah, so
who wins the golf?
Close. Do you know?
Because you used to be teammates. I mean, this is awful to think you compete against each other.
He's very sneaky. I would say without being too arrogant here, I'd say I was the better golfer, but he's been getting lessons. Not good, Owen, and he's improving. And the last time he did beat me.
Is that, you're allowed to have lessons if you come from the amateur code, from the amateur days.
Well, you're right.
That's not right at all, is it?
Exactly.
Building up to sort of the mid-80s, so you made your debut in 79. You were a teacher. I was just looking at the results. That 83, the Scotland team won one Six Nations game, one of the four Six Nations games. So there's no real indication that you're a team that's on the turn, about to come really good. Did nevertheless you think that you played international rugby 5 years before 1984 came around? Did you feel that you were a team about to go somewhere?
We did, Owen, and it probably goes back a couple of years. Jim Telfer took over coaching the team, and he took us to New Zealand and Australia, and these were tough tours, but we nearly beat the All Blacks in Dunedin. In fact, we should have beaten them.
And that was in 82?
That was in 81.
Mm-hmm.
In 81. And we played really well. We got a bit of a doing the second test. But I think we still scored two or three tries in the second test. So we came back from that tour and we got a lot of confidence from it. And then the next again summer, we went to Australia, and that was when Bob Dwyer took over.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a really interesting tour there. We beat Australia in the first test, but lost in the second test. And then the next again year, there was eight of us toured with the Lions to New Zealand. So that was more or less half the team. And although, again, we got a bit of doing off the All Blacks, we managed to talk Jim into, because I think Jim was ready to walk away from rugby after that tour. But the senior player said, look, we think we've got a team that could win the Grand Slam. And I think generally Scottish players lack a wee bit of confidence, maybe that other nations have.
But yeah.
When you've been on a Lions tour, you get to know your opposition really well. You know, you're with them for 12, 14 weeks. I can't remember how long that tour was. And at the end of it, you think, well, there's eight of us here. We've got some good players. But I mean, David Leslie never made that tour, and he was probably the outstanding number seven in the four countries. So we talked Jim into it, and we thought, we've got a real chance.
Just from that 1983 tour, you say you got to know the other players well.
Mm-hmm.
But that, did that sort of persuade you that you were as good as them?
And yes, Owen. And that's what I'm saying. I believe...
So all some reputations, you kind of go, well, actually, we're all human around here.
That's right. And I found out when we met in London, we had to do a bit of fitness testing. And, you know, the Scottish boys were pretty close to being the best. We had a good tour, and I think we gained a lot of confidence from it. And then we played the All Blacks in the November before that season, and we drew 25-all with them. We probably should have won that game. Peter Dodds, who was a fantastic goal kicker, missed a conversion that would have been our first ever win against the All Blacks.
So, well, that must have been the proof in the pudding, if you like, that you were ready to go.
There was a team there.
But I love the idea that you thought about this. You thought that this could be our year, and so much so that you took Telfer aside and said, we need you to stay.
We did. And, you know, fortunately for everybody, Jim stayed on. And it was really brilliant for Jim, because he deserved something like a Grand Slam for what he put into rugby. And I mean, when he first took over the team, we were a soft touch. That's the truth. He turned us into men, really. And particularly at Murrayfield, we became a team that was very hard to beat at home.
And was he, could you tell that he was ahead of his time? I mean, he's one of the great coaches in British world rugby, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. He was ahead of his time. He had the team rocking so well. Oh, and it was just such a treat to play behind a pack like that, and they could create really quick ball. And for guys like Roy and our back row, Scotland at that time had probably eight or nine back row players that could have fitted into the national team.
Did he put the crackle of fear into you as well? Because he did have a bit of that, didn't he?
I remember Jim Calder telling me, Jim was one of the, he was number six in that team, we're sitting having a beer after one of the games, and he said, you know, I made a mistake out there, and the first thing I thought about was, Telfer's got to bring this up at the team meeting. This is during a game. And he was very good motivator, and he knew he could pick on you. But the players would have a good laugh as well, but he was a terrific motivator. And before the Irish game, the Friday night, that was a Triple Crown game, he's very clever. We had a team meeting, and he says, right, I'm going to have my tea. I want you to watch this tape. And the south of Scotland, who had 11 players in that team, we had played the All Blacks and been hammered at Gala. And he had the highlights of that game. So just to bring our feet back to the ground again, he made us watch this. So he was a psychologist as well as a coach.
How did that make you feel to watch?
Well, it was really to get your feet back in the ground.
Yeah.
And then the next again day would start to build you up again. But, you know, we were speaking earlier, and you were saying, you know, what does it take to win a Grand Slam? You need a team coming together at the one time. I think you need units in the team, Owen, that are playing really well together. Like with that terrific back row, we had Ian Milne, who's possibly the best tight head in the world at that time, Colin Deans, with a good captain in Aitken, experienced halfbacks, and a lot of speed. David Johnston, Keith Robertson, guys like that, Peter Dodds, they were quick. But the other thing you need is a massive dollops of luck. And I'm sure the other former players that you interview will say the same thing.
But we've got to sort of slightly set this in context. I love the idea that you thought about this and you said this could be our year. But Scotland hadn't even won a Triple Crown since 1938.
No.
And no Grand Slam since 1925.
Yeah.
So you were doing something, or you were attempting something, you thought you could achieve something that was very, very special. I just got this quote from Jim Telfer, which you probably know very well, which after you've done it, he said, "It was like reaching the South Pole. It hadn't been done by almost any living Scotsman." I mean,
that's right. It was 1938, wasn't it? Yeah. The last team that won the Grand Slam.
1925, the previous team.
Was it?
Yeah. 38 was the last Triple Crown.
Having toured with these players and having played so many, many games with them, and we had a style of play that was very difficult to play against, and we knew we had a good chance, especially with Jim coaching, but you still need a lot of luck going.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Can you remember the time or the era, if you like, of just Torvald and Dean won a gold medal while you were in the middle of your Grand Slam? That was Bolero.
Is that right?
Yeah, Frankie Goes to Hollywood were number one with Relax for most of the time that Six Nations went on. Greenham Common was full of objectors. What was on your minds then, apart from this?
Yeah.
Was it just that?
Well, I think when you're playing at that level, you're a bit of a rugby nut, and personally speaking, I was pretty focused on rugby and becoming a better player, and so really most of the time you were, although we were amateurs, I think we were probably rugby boars as well.
Okay, well, good for you. You had full time jobs as well. Did you feel that you were, 10 years later, players started to feel that you were having unfair expectations and demands placed on you because you were effectively being a professional in your working life and in your rugby life? Did you feel that at all, or did you just feel a pleasure to be?
I was very lucky in that I had the kind of job where I could keep myself pretty fit, being a PE teacher, and I had a good school who allowed me time off, whereas people like, well, Roy, for instance, when he was an electrician in Jed, and it was very difficult for it. He worked for a small business. Hmm. So for him to go on tour, which could be five or six weeks in the summer, he would have to go unpaid. And I actually remember...
So he'd lose hundreds of pounds.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember Roy telling me...
No one made that up. The SIU didn't say, if you're touring for us, we'll make up the deficit.
You got, if my memory serves me right, when you got a fiver a day. You did in expenses. But they used to have a whip round Jed Forest Rugby Club for Roy, so that he had a bit of money to spend on tour. But that's just what it was like. I was fortunate in that, you know, my employers paid me and gave me the time off.
And the school holidays, presumably.
Yeah, but a lot of the time it didn't coincide with school holidays. That was just the way it was. It'd be the same in all the different nations then.
First up, in 1984, in the Five Nations, you played Wales away at Cardiff. Did you feel that day one we're at the start of a big project here, and was that very much in your minds?
Yeah. Well, it sounds simple, but you've got to get off to a winning start.
Yeah.
And I do recall we were quite a nervous team, but we had played Wales 2 years before, and we had probably played as good a game as that team had, and we beat Wales 5-1. So we'd got over this not being able to win down there. We were probably a better side than Wales, but they had some really good individual players. Mm-hmm. And what I do remember, and this is what I was talking about earlier, you need a dollop of luck. We were defending our line desperately at the end of the game, and they had a scrum half. I think his name was Mark Douglas, and he was a big, physical scrum half, a bit like Terry Holmes. And he went round the blind side with probably seconds to go, and he dropped the ball over the line. So
Stuart Hogg style.
Stuart Hogg. Well, I think he had Roy hanging onto his legs.
Just to bring that into the modern age. Oh, so not as bad as Stuart Hogg then.
But the first dollop of luck was Mark dropping the ball over the line, because I think that might have, with the conversion, drawn us level. But it got us off to a winning start.
Mm-hmm. And then you have England at home. And I'm just interested in the sort of the social history, if you like, because 6 years later there was another Scottish Grand Slam, which was completed at Murrayfield against England in the very, very famous grudge match. David Soul walking out, Will Carling, Margaret Thatcher, poll tax, all the history, and it was an extraordinary time. The way it's recounted, anyway, is the players, the Scottish team at the time, were hugely motivated by nation and nationality and politics, if you like, and them and us. And and your team in 84, did you have a driving force like that? Did you have that thing?
We got on great with English lads. The ones in the Lions tour, like Peter Winterbottom, Clive Woodward was on that tour, John Carlton, Dusty Hare, they were great blokes. And I probably got on better with English lads than any other nation. So no, there was. It was obviously Scotland, England. It's a big game, but it was nothing like that 1990 game. And we, England were good. I think that team had beaten the All Blacks. Now, we had drawn with the All Blacks, so they were a formidable side. But it was wet and windy one, and the way England played, their two wingers, John Carlton and Mike Slemon, both fantastic players, they lay very flat, and it gave us acres of room to put the ball behind them.
So you were kicking in behind them?
In behind them, and we put a lot of pressure on Dusty that game. And we had great, guys like David Johnston, and I think Steve Munro probably played that game. Roger Baird, he was a talent, and we just put a lot of pressure on England. They were trying to play probably a wee bit too much rugby with the conditions, and we got quite a lucky try. David Johnston had a kick and chase try. Second half, we scored a good try. Ewan Kennedy, and I think over the piece we probably played the conditions better. But dollop of luck, we got the conditions that suited Scotland and not England.
There's a line that I found in the book that you co-wrote with Roy Laidlaw. This is Roy Laidlaw writing this chapter, and he's talking about you kicking in behind Carlton and Mike Sleman. And he said, John's tormenting of dusty hair that afternoon compounded the sorrows of that great servant of Leicester who had so unhappy a day with his goal-kicking that his wife, for the first time since they were married, could bear to watch no longer and slipped quietly from the ground.
I think that's right. I think dusty...
I love the way he expressed that.
Dusty hair would have been the greatest goal-kicker of his generation. And I think he missed six or seven kicks that day. So but again, the conditions were horrendous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's the second game. Ireland were third, and we were looking at the possibility of a triple crown.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of excitement round about that between the two games.
The Ireland game, you won quite easily.
Yeah,
well,
but
the scoreboard suggests so anyway.
Yeah, I think they won the toss, and there was a bit of a gale force wind going on, and Willie Duggan decided to play into it, which probably was the wrong thing to do. We were extremely motivated, and we managed to, well, Laidlaw's corner. Roy scored two tries the first half, and we played in
that corner that then became known.
In that corner, Laidlaw's corner. It was. I don't know how many tries he scored there, if you included his games with the Scotland A, but a lot, and it gave us a good buff at half time. And then Ireland, as you'd expect, really came at us the second half, and we defended well, and we pulled. I think we scored five tries in that game. The last two were really quite good team tries, but we lost Roy at half time.
It's a concussion, didn't he?
This is quite a story. My Selkirk halfback partner, Gordon Hunter, was the reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Roy was taken off with concussion, but you weren't allowed to say that word. It was athlete's migraine.
Really?
Yes, or concussion. That was your 2 weeks. You had to take a compulsory 2 weeks off. And it became even more important because Gordon Hunter, who was the clear number two to Roy, running off the pitch at the end, collided with a supporter, fractured his cheekbone. So from having our two best scrum halves...
You had none.
With none at the end of the game... So we were all out in the lash, winning the Triple Crown. Poor Roy spent the night in hospital, but we were very aware of not saying the C word, so we could get Roy back for the following week, where we played France in the Grand Slam decider. So...
Concussion was a controversy even in those days.
Nothing like now.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there was no concussion checks, but I mean, Roy was knocked out.
Yeah. When you achieved that Triple Crown, which, as you said, was the first for decades, was there any sense of rest on your laurels with this is a great achievement? I mean, you could have taken your foot off the pedal at that stage. Yeah. I don't know where your heads were in that, but I did read that some SRU blazers were thinking, well, that's all right, that's enough.
Well, that might have happened with committee, but no. This is where Jim Aitken, who was a very underrated captain, he was really good. And, you know, he spoke after the game about, look, you know, got the Triple Crown, let's go for the big one now, we'll have a good week of training. And same with Jim Telfer. But again, Owen, we only got together on Thursday.
Right.
And
so when you say a good week of training, you actually mean a good day and a half of training.
Correct. But we rested up well and made sure if you had an injury that you were seen to and rehab properly leading up to the Thursday.
And for the Grand Slam game against France, I mean, France were... They were the big dogs at the time, weren't they? They were generally the best team in the Five Nations at that time.
They were fantastic. Their back division, who I could almost name, Gallia in the scrum half, fantastic player.
Yeah.
Les Kabura, who, you know, I thought I could kick a ball, add another 20 metres on. He was a good player, but what a huge kicker.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cordonieu and Sella in the centre. Mm-hmm. Estev. Blanco
at the back.
I can't remember who the other winger was. But they would have been far away the best backline, probably in the world at that time.
And did you as a Scotland team feel like that you were underdogs? Were you punching above your weight? Was that sort of the mentality you had?
It was. We knew that we had to be right on top of our game and they had to be just a little bit off. You hope that you get the big decisions.
Yeah.
And we probably did. And probably the biggest incident that helped us was Gallien got carted, I think, just before half-time. Courtesy of a David Leslie shoulder, I think.
Carted as in carted off? Yeah. Not carded as in...
No. And Gallien had just scored, and he was in full flow, class player, Owen. But unfortunately, he hit David Leslie's shoulder, and it was
most fortuitous collision.
I know. But and that really hit. Although Barbizio was a very good replacement, but they were still, I would say, over the piece, they were a better side than us.
Really?
Yes.
You could tell.
Yep. Yeah. You really physically, they were strong and just quick and just playing at a different pace than us. But we just. That team knew how to get over the line, and we took every chance that came our way. And
so you were a good match playing team then?
We were. We took our chances. Peter Dodds was an outstanding goal kicker, Owen.
And you got into their heads a bit as well?
Yes, and the last 10 minutes, they kind of lost the plot. You could almost tell that we were going to win the game. They were doing crazy things.
Like?
Penalties, giving away penalties, obstruction. Blanco, who I would have to say was a great player, he did a couple of daft things. And it allowed us to stay in their 22 for the last 10 minutes. Mm. They just couldn't get out the 22. And of course, the crowd were cheering us on. And we just weren't going to let that lead go. And as it happened, you know, we came off and... Incredible.
So go on. I mean, was best rugby day of your life? Or
yeah, absolutely. It was very emotional, I would say, because we knew we'd done something special. The supporters didn't normally run onto the pitch, but I mean, the pitch, you couldn't see a blade of grass. It was just surrounded, and no, it was really special and big dinner tonight. To be fair, the French boys, they were excellent at the dinner. These were big occasions, the after match functions.
Fantastic.
But here it is, back to work on Monday.
Back to school on Monday.
Everybody back to work.
Fantastic.
And then you just had to get on with your life. So it was actually poor Roy again. There was a famous story on Monday. Jim Aitken organised a lunch in Edinburgh for all the team and the coaches. And Roy was the only person that didn't make it.
Because he was at work.
And his job that day, Owen, was rewiring the public toilets in Jed. And we were all out in Edinburgh. I think we'd all been given a day off by our employers. And poor Roy, he was rewiring the toilets.
Yeah. Fantastic. Talking about the sort of the fleeting nature of success and how it comes and how easily it can go. 84, you win the Grand Slam, but 85, I think you lost all four.
We did.
So what? How do you go from great to not great?
A lot of injuries. Quite a few of that team were struggling that way. But if you looked at the scores in all these games, when they were really tight.
So it just shows the margins. It's a cliche, but margins are so tight. And...
Absolutely. But every single game that Scotland played that season, they could have won. But whereas we won the four games the season before, we couldn't do it. But
that's really interesting.
I remember myself that season. I really struggled with it with injury. That's just rugby.
And finally, if you're talking to Stuart Hoggall, one of the Six Nations captains today, how to win a Grand Slam, what do you say to them?
Well, it's like I say all the way through this interview. You need a good team, but you need dollops of luck. So you need to take every opportunity that comes your way. And I think for Scottish teams, that's the only way you can do it.
rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.